history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you with some incredible stories to tell. All we need to do is ask a few questions and take the time to listen. And we do that each week as we honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and many times inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a 92-year-old today in Bakersfield, California, also known as the Oklahoma of California. And I think that'll be proven true today with Vernon Martin, because you are from Oklahoma, and your hometown near Tahlequah, which is the headquarters of the Cherokee Nation, Eldon, Oklahoma. I don't think I've ever met anyone from Eldon, Oklahoma. How big a place was that when you were growing up?
It had two stores, a sawmill, a cotton gin, and about 15 houses.
That's about it.
That was it. And a train station and a railroad that went through there.
All right. So it was a happening place.
Mm-hmm.
What was your childhood like that? Did you have a big family?
No. Well, yeah, I had six brothers and sisters. I had one sister and five brothers, and it was great. My dad was, he bought ties, railroad ties, and he also clerked at a great big store that sold everything. If you wanted to buy a cultivator, you could.
Mm.
Then he had a big blacksmith shop.
So I bet you grew up helping in that blacksmith shop.
Yeah. I didn't do much help, but I was always over there.
I bet you had to sweep the floor a few times.
No, it's dirt floor. I did one thing. I'll tell this. I was in the blacksmith shop, and we all went barefooted back then in the summertime. He had a hatchet laying up on a workbench, and I got it and set a block up. I was going to split that block, and I split my big toe open.
Oh, ouch.
So he put me on his shoulder and carried me home, which we just lived a block or so from there.
But you didn't get your big toe clean off anyway, huh?
I don't even know what they used to sterilize anything back then. We never had mercurochrome or iodine or anything like that. I think Mama took hot water and put my foot in it and poured Epsom salts in there. I think that was the way they took care of it.
And where did you fit into that seven children progression there? Which one were you?
I was next to the last.
So you had some big brothers to toughen you up, huh?
Yeah, I had Earl and Jay and Paul, then Ruby, my sister, and then I, and then my brother Dennis.
All right. How many of you brothers ended up in World War II?
Earl and Paul and me. Earl was in the CBs, and I was in the airborne outfits eventually, and my brother was in the 14th Armored Division in Europe.
You didn't ever run into him, did you?
After the war, I went to Paris on a furlough, and I met a guy that out of the 14th Division, and I found out where he was in Germany. When we got back to my outfit there in Germany, I went to my first sergeant and told him I found my brother, and I'd like to go up and see him. And he said, well, we'll just go up there in the morning. So he got a Jeep, and we went up there and found him.
That had to be a highlight.
Yeah, it was. You know, they build the houses in front, and then they have a yard in the back.
Right.
And his outfit was, he was eating dinner or something whenever I went in. I walked through there and back, and he started to take a bite, and he looked up and saw me, and his mouth just flew open. I stayed up there two or three days with him, and then he got a Jeep and took me back to Heidelberg, Germany.
So you had a couple days with each other there. Here you'd both been in all kinds of situations, I'm sure, since you last seen each other. Did you guys trade some war stories there?
No. We talked about our family and back home, and we never talked about the war hardly.
But three boys went off to war, and all three came home. Your mama must have been doing some praying back home in Oklahoma.
I guess so, because we all got back. Earl got back a month before I did, and then I got back 2 days before my brother, older than me, got back.
Those growing up years, though, in Oklahoma. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories from guys who lived through the Great Depression, and some of them in that part of the country. And it sure sounded like a far cry from what most of us have known in recent years. What do you remember about those years and the way things were?
We never knew about all the stuff we have now to buy. You had one pair of shoes a year, and you had maybe two or three pair of bib overalls and a couple of shirts, and that was your wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a real sparse life, but you didn't know of all these things that we know of nowadays. How can you want something when you don't even know what it is?
Amen. Maybe we're better off not knowing. At that age, do you remember having some ambitions or some dreams or ideas of what you wanted to do when you grew up?
No. I guess maybe all I wanted to do was just grow up.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't have no specific thoughts of what I was going to be, and nobody ever suggested anything to me.
And at age 17, you know, people today, when you say the CCC, they don't know what you're talking about. But at this time, before World War II, this was a big investment domestically in America after the Depression, putting people to work, having these public service projects. What made you decide to sign up for that Civilian Conservation Corps?
Because my brother Paul, older than me, he went in it when he was 17 years old, and he stayed 5.5 years.
Wow.
I looked around. There was nothing for me to do, nothing to work. I joined the CC camps, and I got them to send me where I thought it was close. He was in Cortez, Colorado, and they sent me to Mesa Verde, National Park, and I thought I could see him. But in the meantime, I'll tell this on him. Because he was so mean. What I mean, he just wouldn't take nothing off anybody. And being a CC camp boy, they got first pick on the girls in Cortez and other places wherever they was. So the sheriff come out. My brother fought all the time, every time he went to town. And the sheriff came out and said, if you don't get Paul out of here, they're going to kill him. So he discharged Paul, and Paul went to my older brother, which lived in Valparaiso, Indiana. He could take a Caterpillar tractor all apart. He could take one of those tanks over there all apart, put it back together. That was the way they got him out of Cortez.
Uh-huh.
And then he joined the Army way before the war started.
And what about you? What were you doing up there at that camp?
The first thing I'd done was work in a National Park Service garage where they worked on the vehicles. And I was changing a tire with a tire iron and trying to get it off the wheel, the rim, and the devil slipped out and hit me in the mouth and knocked two teeth out.
Oh.
So I knew doing mechanic work wasn't going to be my line. So I got a job. I was guide in a national park. I'd take one or two parties down to this big Indian ruin there in Mesa Verde.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'd take 15 people or so down, but they trained me, the rangers did, what to say and all about the ruins, and I'd take these people down there and be sure they all got back up to the starting point and answer questions to them and everything.
You're getting paid for this. You keeping that money, you're sending it back home to Oklahoma?
My brother Paul sent $25, I believe it was, out of his pay back to Dad and Mom for 5.5 years. But I couldn't send any back whenever I went in because they was already getting this government money, and they wouldn't allow two sons of one family send money back to the folks. So I got all of my pay, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like maybe $28-$30.
Well, and I've had a lot of guys tell me over the years that, you know, being in a CCC camp prepared them for the Army, that there was some discipline and kind of a military-style execution to it that was going to get them ready for what they eventually did. Did you have that experience?
I sure did. In the mornings, we got up just in time to get down for breakfast, but at night, we had flag lowering and all that stuff. Had to dress in Class A uniform and all that. When I first went in, we had a first lieutenant as our commanding officer, and it was all run just like the Army.
And is that where you were on December 7th? 1941?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're at that camp?
Uh-huh.
How'd you hear the news?
Sunday morning, I got up, and the time difference between over there in Hawaii and Mesa Verde, well, we got the news about 12 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And I got up and looked out, and there's a whole bunch of my buddies gathered around the door going into the mess hall. So hurried on down there. Our commanding officer was telling about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. And that's where I first heard it.
Was that a shocker to you? Was that kind of hard to digest?
No. Being stupid, you know, but not knowing world affairs or anything, it didn't worry me much. But I cared. I didn't like people jumping on to us.
And your brother was already in the service.
Uh-huh.
So you knew he's going to be involved in this.
Yeah.
When did you decide, hey, it's going to happen to me too, I'm going to be part of this?
Well, now this is getting into my private life. My girlfriend, I knew her since we was 9 years old. She was just born and raised 2 miles up the creek from me. I went with her all the time until I was 17. I went to the CC camps. And I wrote her 2 letters in a year while I was gone. But anyhow, when I got back, why, she was still not married. She was 17 and I was 18 by then. There are pictures over there. She's such a pretty woman, her blonde hair and all that.
Uh-huh.
And she had so many boyfriends, you had to stand in line to get a date with her. But anyhow, I went to town. Everybody went to town on Saturdays, especially all of the two high schools. Kids that went to the high school there. And so I rode a bus over there, and I got off this bus and started walking up toward Oklahoma State University, big campus up there. And here come Elsie and JB, my best friend, walking down the sidewalk. And he said, well, here comes Vernon. I won't get to go with you anymore. And he never did. Elsie never went with any, and after I got back, she never went with any of her boyfriends that I knew of.
He knew right there and then he couldn't compete with you?
I guess so.
So did you get married before you went over?
Yeah, I got back in August and I went with her till we got married on the 20th of December. I come back in August and we got married on 20th of December.
And when did you go in the Army?
I stayed as long as I could.
Well, I'm sure you just got married. Who wouldn't want to stay?
So they drafted me and they sent me to Fort Sill. I got 22 weeks of basic training there in the pack artillery. In other words, I think maybe a battalion would have like 15 mules in my section. Huh. And then they had 4 sections, so that's 60 mules. Plus we had a maintenance section, and they had about 20 mules. We had nearly 100 mules in each battery. I took training in that there, and they sent me to the 10th Mountain Division in Camp Hale, Colorado, 10,000 feet elevation. And we had mules up there, too. I went home on furlough, and I got back up there, and up at the mule barns, why, the first sergeant come out and said, anybody that will volunteer to go overseas can be sent to Paso Robles, California at Camp Roberts, because that outfit was getting ready to, they'd been to Kiska, and they was getting ready to go over to Europe. We didn't know it at that time.
So this the 602nd Field Artillery Battalion.
You know, living in a place where it's 10 below zero at 10,000 feet elevation, sleeping out on the snow and on a manny, what we call a 6x4 canvas, piece of canvas. They'd lay that down and put you sleeping bag. You had 2 sleeping bags, put one inside the other and sleep on that snow. And I didn't like that very much. So the first sergeant came up and said, anybody that volunteer to go overseas can be shipped to Paso Robles.
So you would rather go overseas and get in combat than be stuck at Camp Hale?
Right.
All right.
That's how I went overseas.
How'd your wife feel about that?
I never told her. Well, later I did.
Yeah. And when you were there at Camp Hale, did you go through those big maneuvers they had there?
Yeah. I was in the mules, and they all rode skis.
Right. But you never did that. You'd have to lead a mule-drawn piece of artillery up the snowy slopes.
Yeah. They had what they call Phillips pack saddles, that each saddle was designed for one piece of this artillery. That mule carried that. That was his load. The heaviest load of the whole gun was 235 pounds, which the mule carried. And the saddle weighed 95 pounds. And that was the load on the mule.
I'm just curious, have you ever been talking to someone and told them what you did in World War II and gotten a funny look like they had no idea that mules were used in World War II?
Yeah, lots of times.
That's kind of a unique distinction. A lot of people don't even know that and probably don't even believe you sometimes.
Well, I'll tell you, we called them Missouri mules that we had in Camp Hale. They were larger than the regular mule because they've special picked for this operation. And I'll tell you about those who had mangers, had quarters for them and had mangers, and they, you took them in there and you tied them, and they had a halter on, you just snapped it in there. But you couldn't walk back out to the walkway, because if you did, he'd put you on the other side of the barn.
He'd kick you?
Kick you, he would, or bite you, or anything he could do.
Did you learn that the hard way, or by other guys learning the hard way?
They told me what to do. So you'd get at the door where you come in, you'd get up on the manger and walk back to where you assigned a mule. And you'd walk back to this mule, and you'd unsnap the cord that was holding him, and then you'd back him out of the stall, never get behind him, because if you did, you got kicked.
Uh-huh.
This first sergeant, little bitty guy, but he was really hard-crusted. So he came up to where we was at the mule barn, and that's where I volunteered to go overseas.
Did it occur to you at all that you might be putting yourself in greater danger by doing that?
Well, when you're just 18, you don't think you could ever anything happen to you. I don't know where other people feel like that. I've heard them say, you don't think anything's going to happen to you.
You never thought, man, I'm going to leave behind a teenage widow?
Yeah, I never thought of that. But anyhow, the guys I took basic training with in Fort Sill, I told them what I was going to do. And Brown and Late and a couple of three more of my good friends, they ran right over and volunteered to go just because we was together.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about Mr. Martin's experiences with the 602nd Field Artillery Battalion. Mules, gliders, who knows where his story might take us. Check out the photos of him then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Vernon Martin of Bakersfield, California. I want to thank one of our longtime listeners there on affiliate KNZR, David Gifford, for letting me know about his Uncle Vernon, who told us about growing up in the tiny town of Eldon, Oklahoma. He got his first taste of California in 1939 when he came out with family and spent the summer picking peaches in Modesto. When he passed through Bakersfield on that trip, little did he know he'd end up spending most of his life there as a plumber and pipe fitter. He's been in Bakersfield since 1956, but let's go back into his World War II story now. After volunteering to go overseas, he was sent to Camp Roberts in Paso Robles, California, to join the 602nd Field Artillery Battalion.
Well, when I got there, the 602nd came back from Kiska. They gave them all furloughs, and they was just a skeleton crew there, maybe 15 men out of the whole battalion. Our commanding officer sent them all a telegram, get back as fast as you can, because the Army said that we had to be in Italy at a certain time. So they all come back in, and I was new in the outfit. The 23 guys that came in, they all looked down on us because they'd been to Kiska and been in combat and everything, and we were just new.
Uh-huh.
And they never let us get ahead.
I'm sure they didn't. And your battalion has a pretty unique distinction. Before you joined it, they made that amphibious landing up in the Aleutians at Kiska, and then you would be part of an airborne assault in August of 1944 in southern France. And in between, you're working with mules in the mountains. I don't know too many units that did that variety of things. It's a pretty unique outfit you had there.
Well, we landed in Italy, and they rounded up these mules someplace. They put us on a train and shipped us to the southern part of Italy.
So the mules didn't come with you?
No, they brought them in later, but they were really not the mules that we was used to, but they made out all right. And they brought those mules in, and none of them was broke to saddle and carry loads. So we would take five men, one man on each mule's ear, and then one man with a twitch. You know what a twitch is?
Tell us.
It's a stick about this long, and it's got a rope in it, a hole drilled through, and a rope in there plaited together, and it's about this long. And they take that, and they take the bottom lip of the mule, and they put this rope on there and twist it.
Right.
And that's what you hold a mule with.
Uh-huh.
And then two men would take the saddle and put on the mule and cinch it down and take a bag of oats and tie onto the mule and turn him loose and let him go, and he'd run off through the fields bucking, and that was the way we broke them.
Well, and it just kind of strikes me, Harriet spent all this time training with mules. I'm sure they never taught you how to break in a mule. You guys had to probably figure that out on your own after you're already over there in a war zone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And I know we're jumping around, but what about the ride over there? What about the voyage across the ocean?
Well, we was at Camp Patrick Henry in Newport News, Virginia, and we was there for maybe, I can't remember exactly, but it was over a week. They took us down to the docks. They had forklifts down there with gasoline engines in them, and all we done was race each other around the docks. But anyhow, when it come time for us to go, I might should not say this, but you have to take a physical. All we had on was a pair of combat boots and a slicker and our helmet. No clothes underneath that.
Uh-huh.
And we marched down the street at this Camp Patrick Henry to a doctor to inspect us.
Right.
And all we had to do was just walk in, just pull our slicker back, and there we was, stark naked. I bet no very few people ever done that.
Marched with just combat boots, a helmet, and a slicker on? Yeah. Likely not. At least not for those reasons.
To get your physical examination to go overseas.
Yeah.
They put us on the boat, and it sat there in the port till it got dark, and they slowly pulled it out. By the time we got out to the ocean, why, it was dark. But the next morning we woke up, and as far as you could see was ships. I don't know how many there was on there. We was next to a British ship. We was kind of on the outside, which is a bad place to be.
Yeah, there's submarines around for sure.
Yeah, well, they tried to get us.
You guys had an encounter with U-boats?
Oh, yeah, and sub chasers. They run right by our boat. We thought they was going to run into us, and they'd run pretty fast. I don't know how fast they'd go. And off the back of it was rolling these big barrels, depth charges.
Yeah.
It makes a heck of a boiling of water and all that.
Sure.
And they wasn't too far from our boat.
So you're watching this show?
Yeah.
From the deck of your ship?
Uh-huh.
As a 19-year-old kid?
Yeah.
One big adventure, huh?
Among a lot of others. But no, it's silly to say you can look back on that and enjoy it. Right then, it was pretty serious.
Uh-huh.
But then, it's a learning experience. It took us 28 days to cross from there, Newport News, Virginia, to Sicily. And they put us in there, and then we got in the air raid.
As soon as you got there, first night.
First night.
And you haven't debarked the ship. You're still on the ship.
Yeah.
And do you see?
Well, first thing come on was these big 20 million candle power lights. I don't know what candle power they are, but they're huge things. They was on shore, and they pick up these German planes, and then the anti-aircraft starts firing at them. They never bothered our ship or anything. As soon as they got out of range, well, they shut all that down. I don't know where the planes went. They was probably 12 planes or something like that.
But you're seeing the planes coming in and the tracers going up, and it's quite a show for your first night there.
It's a big show. The next morning, they started the ship up, and we landed in Naples. Got off a boat there at Naples, and there was some kind of a university or something on shore there. And Army had took over that. And that's where we stayed. We stayed there for maybe a week, and they put us on a train, and we went south out of there. If you've never rode a train, you should ride one of those European trains. It's really an adventure. Most of the time, you're in a cattle car. But this is just like you could look over the sides. But anyhow, we got down there, and they gathered the whole battery together, and we got a tent. We slept on the ground for a long time, and it rained, and water had run under there, and it was very uncomfortable. But then they got us folding cots, and then that's whenever we got the mules in there and began training them.
So you had to start from scratch with all these mules that needed to be broken in and train them to carry these loads. And how did that work with one of these howitzer teams? How was that all divvied up?
It took 6 mules to carry one gun.
Uh-huh.
That gun broke down into 6 different pieces. But everybody in the crew knew how to do everything on the gun. You could fire the gun. You could do all the ammo. I took care of the ammo most of the time.
Uh-huh. And this 75 millimeter?
Uh-huh. And it had a shell that the powder bags went in.
All right.
And my job, they had time fuses, and they had instant fuses, and they had delayed fuses, and then they had smoke. If they wanted this round to go off at so many feet above the ground, well, I set the timing on it. I had a little wrench. You could set the seconds and everything on it, and I'd set that. Once it was so far out of the muzzle of that gun, it automatically armed that round.
Right.
However many seconds you'd set on that, it got to that, and that was whenever it exploded. You wanted it to explode like 20 feet above the ground because of the shrapnel would spread out.
So you said 6 mules for every gun. How many men for every gun?
We had 14 men in a section. We could set our gun up with the crew on it. You had the gunner, chief of section, and you had number one man and the ammunition man and the trail man that moved the trail around to help line it up. We could take and set this gun up, and those mules would be in line, and we could tear that gun down and take it and put it on those mules, move 50 yards, take it off, and set it up and fire around in less than 2 minutes.
Wow.
That was the way they trained us.
It's like a NASCAR pit crew or something. And how did the mules handle when you actually fired that sucker?
They'd take them off and a ways on a picket line. But the mules, we was in this place just out of Rome in the big tall trees, and first sergeant would come out. He was in Chicago, Illinois. I really got along good with him. He was an excellent army man. And he'd scream out, "Bag 'em out." That meant get the feed bags and go down and get their food and take it and put it around there. It fit over their neck and up under their mouth mm-hmm. for them to eat. And as soon as that sergeant said those words, those mules just start braying. They knew exactly what was coming.
I could ask you a lot of seemingly dumb questions, but here's one of them. When you've got 6 different mules in your team, and who knows how many total mules you end up working with throughout the war, can you tell one mule from another?
My mule was a gray mule.
Yeah?
You could tell it any place. But all of them, were, you could tell your mule.
Did you name that mule?
No, I never did name it. It was the only gray mule in the whole battery. I'll tell you, whenever I was taking basic training in Fort Sill, the animal came first. Nobody got to do anything, any comforts or anything, until every mule was taken care of. Hmm. And there were certain procedures that you had to do to that mule. You know, curry it down, clean its all of its hoofs out. That mule had to be spotless after you come back in off of wherever you went. I had this mule down there in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and it was a mouse-colored mule, and you could not pick up its back feet unless you wanted to get hurt.
Uh-huh.
So this first or second lieutenant, I think he was, come by, and they'd watch you to see if you were doing it according to procedure. And he watched me, and I'd never picked up his back feet and cleaned them out. You got a knife where you take them and clean them all out and get all everything stuck up in their hoof out.
Right.
Well, I didn't do that. And he come over there, and he said, "Private Martin, you never cleaned those back feet out on that mule." And I said, "No, sir." I said, "That mule's kind of mean." And he said, "Well, I'll clean them out." This mule laid it on him. He must have knocked him 15 feet.
I bet he never made that mistake again.
No, as far as I know, nobody ever cleaned that mule's back feet out.
Did he have anything to say to you afterwards?
Mm-mm.
So when you're working with all these guys and all these mules, Does it feel like those animals are a part of the team too, or almost as important or valuable as the people?
Those mules were more valuable than any man. That mule came first, regardless. Before you could do anything to comfort yourself. Whenever we marched, we'd march for 50 minutes and then had a 10-minute break. But the first thing you had to do was be sure your saddle was right, the load was right, the harness on the mule was right before you got to take a break.
What about when you were actually in combat firing those howitzers? What were those situations like? What do you remember about maybe even the first time that you had to put that thing together and let her rip?
Okay, we went up to a little town north of Naples called Minterno. That's where I first went in combat. But they left the mules in the back, and they left people back there to take care of them. I don't know how long we was up there before the push come off that we took Rome, and at the same time they went in from England and took France over there.
Right.
It happened all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. So what are you doing? You're loading the shells in the gun?
Yeah.
And it's firing as fast as you can get them in there?
Well, you get a farting order, and then they say fire two rounds. Generally, one of the guns will fire a round for sighting the guns in.
And you can't see what you're shooting at, probably, right?
No, you don't see it.
You've got a forward observer who's telling you, try this bearing.
Well, they told you the exact bearing.
Uh-huh.
Our command post at our outfit did. They give you the elevation, sideway movement, and then SI. It had an SI deal on there, which I never did find out for sure what it was. But they'd give you an SI setting on that.
And then they're giving you adjustments because you might be too short or too far and they want to zero you in on the target.
Yeah.
So you just keep firing and firing and firing. At what point do you start having fire directed toward you?
Well, a lot of times it's happened before you start firing. And that's happened several times. In fact, my buddy got wounded in that. We was in France. We went in with those gliders, and then we was up in a bare space between two grape vineyards. We was sitting there, hadn't done anything, and all at once did a puff of white smoke come up out in front of us, which was the Germans getting to know what settings on their gun. And so then, instead of firing smoke, they started firing shrapnel shells. There was a big gully behind us, and it was a lot coming in. So me and Brown, my buddy, we ran back through this vineyard about less than my fence out there, and then got over in this ditch, great big ditch, like 15 feet deep. And we got up again the bank, and I looked over, and blood was running out of the side of Brown's face, his head. And I said, Brown, you've been hit. And sure enough, he had. Then we went back up to the gun. They knocked two of our guns out. But I was ammunition man. They gave the firing order, what were the elevation and all that is. And they said, fire at will, which you just as far as fast you can. And being ammunition man, why, it got so fast that I couldn't set all this stuff on there.
Right.
So whatever I picked up, I handed to them. If it was a smoke shell, I handed it to them. If it was a instant fuse, I handed that to them. If it was a delayed fuse, whatever it was, I handed over there and they fired it. I don't know how many rounds we fired, but it was a lot.
What does that sound like?
It's not too loud. 75 is a small piece.
Yeah.
No, whenever we first went to the front, they'd moved all the artillery as close to the front as they could get it. We were sitting like 600 yards from the German lines. But they'd moved this 8-inch howitzers, 155 long toms.
Yeah.
They'd moved them all up as close as they could get them. And then whenever the big push comes on, you could sit there and read a newspaper how light it was, and that was at 11:15 at night.
Because the artillery is lighting up the sky.
They had it strung all the way back, I don't know, like 4 or 5 miles. At that time, it was the largest artillery barrage that had ever been fired.
What was that like to witness that?
Well, the first thing is the whole 4 miles or 5 miles back just lit up like it turned on a bunch of electric lights. And then those guns started firing right down below us. You could read anything.
Was it scary?
Well, would I be bragging if I said, no, it wasn't. It was not scary.
It's kind of exciting?
It was very exciting. All of that firing going on. And the Germans were mad, too, and they was firing at us.
Right. Well, you mentioned when your buddy Brown got hit. Is that the closest it came to getting you when he got hit, or did you have some other close calls?
Yeah, we had, whenever we got to France, we landed in those gliders, and then we went up the coast, went all the way back to Italy again, within about a mile of Italy. We took Monte Carlo, which is Monaco, which is an independent country. We took Nice, France, and all of those towns up the side. But we also had Navy supporting us. I don't know what size ships these was, but they knew how far the Germans' 88s would fire, and they just kept the ships just out of the range of them. Whenever they fired, the ship with just the whole side of it would just be one big blaze. They went along with us with our artillery. We had a lot of support.
But you had a close call over there too? Is that what you were leading into?
Several. I don't want to talk about that.
They hear you talking. You're 92 years old. They can tell how sharp your memory is. They can tell that you're humble and you're not looking to brag. But I get the sense that you're pretty fortunate to be here, that it could have been you a couple times there.
Yeah, I think it could have. I had to get back to my wife. If you get scared, you'd be scared all the time he's there. So you got to where you could live with it.
Right.
I don't know what the other people say about it.
But that's how you dealt with it.
Yeah, pretty soon you just got to where you could live with it.
It's time for another break, but when we come back, we'll hear more about Vernon Martin's experience in a glider as part of Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France in August 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Vernon Martin of Bakersfield, California. From mules on mountains to gliders and grape vineyards, his experience with the 602nd Field Artillery Battalion during World War II in Europe presented him with more than his fair share of close calls. Are there any that you shake your head about and say, boy, how did I get through that one?
Yeah, several of those. You don't think about that. If you make it through, you put it out of your mind. Otherwise, you'd probably go nuts.
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. You referenced the glider. We haven't told that story. So here you've trained with all the mules. That's a dangerous enough duty in its own right. Then they tell you you're going to have to fly in this glider. In other words, there's no engine on this thing. The pilot's going to land it. You're not taken back off. And you're going to get out of that thing and fight behind enemy lines.
Twenty miles
behind enemy lines. How did you feel about that when they gave you that scenario?
I'd never been there before, so I didn't know anything about it.
It's like what you said about the Depression, huh? You don't know what you're missing if you don't know it exists?
Yeah. I guess that's the only way that I can figure it. We was down in this grove of trees that I was talking about. All at once, they picked us up, our battalion, and moved it about 15 miles north of Rome. And we got off the trucks there, and they gave us tents. But they also had a landing field scraped out in a big field out there.
Uh-huh.
And there was gliders sitting out there, and there's C-47 tow planes sitting out there. I don't know how many, maybe 30.
Uh-huh.
But they had these stashed all around over. They just have so many in one place. And then we got together after we got in the air.
Did that make you a little nervous, this idea of taking a Jeep and a howitzer and some guys in a powerless airplane?
Well, would it be bragging if I never worried about it?
No, just being honest.
Well, it was different. Let's put it that way. We go out, we take our gun out, and they have a guy on the plane that shows you how to tie your weight down on the glider to keep it balanced.
Right.
Because it's being towed by another plane, and it's got tie down deals in the floor. You got a 1-inch plywood floor, something like that. And we put that gun in there, and he shows us how to tie it down. And this plane hooks on to us, and on this dirt field, whenever this C-47 takes off, it just tons of dirt and dust comes back. You can't see anything. But anyhow, we was in this glider. This was in training. And it, some way or another, whenever they graded this field out, they put dirt in a hole, and one of the landing gears hit this hole and broke off. And whenever it done that, it left the big old shock sticking in the ground. And whenever the pilot knew what happened, this pilot in the glider, right up above it, there's a handle up there, and you just push this handle, and it opens up the tow rope like this, and he cut us loose from the tow plane. And when he done that, we just went around in a circle with that deal sticking in the ground. Like, scared us to death.
That's like a Disneyland ride or something. But he might have saved your life by cutting you loose.
Well, we probably wouldn't have. Well, yeah, if he'd got us up in the air and we didn't have a landing gear on one side and we hit the ground 100 miles an hour, they ain't no telling what had happened.
Yeah.
But they never got us off the ground. The C-47 might not have ever been able to get us off the ground.
Because of that shock stuck in the ground?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So tell me about when you actually made that glider mission.
We flew across the Mediterranean. I don't know how many gliders it was in the balance that I was. Probably 40 gliders or 50 being pulled before C-47, but everybody took the door off the glider and just threw them out, just dropped them. The whole line of gliders, all their doors were floating down to the ocean. I don't know who gave the orders to take the doors off the gliders. They knew they never was going to use them again because they just pushed them up in a pile and set them on fire. Anyhow, it was, well, not scary because we'd already rode in gliders and everything. But then we got to the French coast, and then we went inland, and it's a American-Canadian outfit. They're infantry.
Uh-huh.
They'd landed before us and secured the fields.
Yeah, that was the 1st Special Service Force, also known as the Devil's Brigade, recent recipients of the Congressional Gold Medal, and there have even been movies made about the Devil's Brigade. And you spent a fair amount of time operating in conjunction with them.
But all these gliders coming in, this vineyard that we landed in, several gliders landed there. But then there's some great big, on the hill over here, there's great big pine trees. And some of these gliders would go over there and run out of airspeed, and they'd just drop down through those trees. But one of the pilots up there in front said, we turned and still had enough speed. But we was heading for this big double road of like cottonwood trees that went down a road. And this one pilot said, no, go up the field, which he did. We landed in these grape vineyards with all, like I said, with steel posts and all that. And
yeah, so what happened to your glider?
Well, it didn't have no bottom left in it.
Got sliced right off like a cheese slicer.
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, there was like 8 men in there, 4 on each side, and we sitting in these wooden benches, and we had a seat belt on. We had her feet up on the gun. The gun never fell out or anything like that, but it tore the boards and all that stuff up. These iron posts did.
Uh-huh. So that doesn't sound like a smooth landing.
No.
What did it feel like?
Well, you hit the ground like, I don't know how fast we're going, say 60 miles an hour, and you run from here to that tree out there. It's a pretty sudden stop. The skis on the glider were gathering these wires up that the vines ran on.
Right.
and the posts were tearing the bottom of the glider out.
Were you kind of wondering if you guys were going to survive that landing?
No.
It wasn't that bad, huh?
Well, it happens so fast, you don't have time to plan anything.
Uh-huh.
You're just flying in, and all at once, you go over and make a circle around over these trees and come back in, and you're going toward these big double row of cottonwood trees, and somebody had enough sense to turn the plane up the field, which we had more room, and then you run 50 feet, and you're dead stop. I happened to, like I told you, I had these side cutters. So I got under the glider because all this wiring, to hold the vines up on these rows of grape had gathered up on the the deals and the wheels. So I got under there with these side cuts and started cutting the wires off. So you couldn't raise the front of it up to get the gun out of it until all those wires were cut off.
So you guys have this weapon you're supposed to use, but no one's going to be able to use it because you can't get it out of the glider.
That's right.
So, and why did you have these side cutters?
I have no idea. Someplace I picked them up and had them in my deal. I don't know what it was.
So if you hadn't done that, you guys wouldn't have really had any way to defend yourself if there were enemy in the area.
Well, we had our sidearms and all that.
Right.
And we also had infantry there with us, too. You didn't have really anything to worry about. There was nobody going to bother you. The Germans couldn't get through these people are guarding our field that we didn't land in.
But outside of that field, it's all German-held territory because you're 20 miles behind the lines.
Yeah.
So you had a lot of fighting from that point till the end of the war.
But the Germans had begun to give up. They just more or less fought defensively. Oh, a few times they let us know they didn't like us.
What was it like to come back and see your wife again?
I had a hard time getting back. We landed in New York City. It was on Christmas Day, and then we got on a train, went down to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. They had Christmas all set up for us. They started processing us, and then they put us on a train, and I ended up in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And then it took a day or so to get my discharge there. On a bus, you had to go to Muskogee, get off that bus, and then go to Tahlequah. And then my wife was 9 miles out of Tahlequah on a farm. So I got to this bus station there in Fort Smith, and a guy said, "Well, where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Muskogee." And he said, "Well, I'm going to Muskogee, too." He had a car. And he said, "I'll take you there." And I said, "Well, how much?" And he said, $6. And he took us to Muskogee. Then it was maybe an hour before that bus run went to Tahlequah. And a guy said, "Well, where are you going?" A taxi drove up. And I told him, "Well, I'm on my way to Tahlequah as soon as this bus comes in." So he took me to Tahlequah. And I got in there. It was about 11 o'clock at night. This bus that I was waiting on there in Muskogee was the one that's going to come through Tahlequah and then take me on out to where my wife was. So there's a taxi cab there. So I asked him, "How much did you take me out 12 miles from Eldon, Oklahoma?" And I don't know, it's like $5, $6, $7. I give him that money. In other words, three different rides to get out to where my wife was. Well, she'd been waiting on the bus, her and her sister, whenever the first bus come through and I wasn't on it. They went back out there and they was all in bed when I got there. Well, the lights went on. And so I went in, and that was whenever I first saw my wife after being gone over 2 years.
You'd been gone from her longer than you'd been married to her before you left.
Oh, yeah, three times as long.
Yeah.
It was like meeting a strange woman again, if you've ever knew how that was. Everybody got up, and we sat there for a long time and talked, and then it come time to go to bed, and that's kind of strange. I didn't even kiss my wife when I got there because all the folks are there.
Yeah.
Back then, you didn't show any emotion around my wife's folks, and if you never lived through it, you don't know how it is.
Uh-huh.
But I hadn't, I don't think I did even kiss my wife after I got there. And so her nephew, he's about 4 years old, and he got up in my lap and laid his head on my chest. It was exciting, let's put it that way. And
a lot different from what you had been dealing with.
Yeah.
You know, before I forget, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us some of your story. Is there anything that, when you look back on your time in uniform, that you'd say you're most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful for all my buddies I had, because we watched out for each other.
Mm.
And your buddy, they came first before anything else.
Did you lose any friends over there?
Yeah, but we never was like the infantry. they took care of us because we had the means of supporting them.
Yeah, they needed you guys and your protection.
And we needed them, too. But it was exciting, if you want to put it that way. One little incident. We went up the coast in Nice, France, and Monte Carlo, and Mentone. All those towns, we occupied them back to the, almost to the Italian border. You've heard of the 442 combat team?
Yep.
And 100th Battalion?
Right.
Well, we was with them over in France, and then they pulled them out and took them back to Italy. But anyhow, they were there with us. It was a guy come from, like, out of Monte Carlo in a rowboat, and he was trying to row across the bay to Italy where the Germans was. The Japanese-American, they took a 50 caliber machine gun and climbed up on top of a building down there just north of Mentone, France, set this machine gun up and started firing at him and made him come to shore. It was a funny deal.
Yeah, busted.
They were Japanese-Americans.
So you served alongside the 442 in the 100th?
The 100th Battalion went with us in the gliders to France out of Italy.
And were you aware that a lot of those guys were fighting for a country that had their families locked up?
Not like I know about it now.
Yeah.
Back then, they were just in uniform, and they were Japanese-Americans, and you didn't want to monkey with them. Of all the people, I think maybe that the Germans dreaded having to fight with those Japanese-Americans because they were really good.
Well, and they paid a heavy price.
They sure
did. A lot of losses.
They sure did. I mean, probably they paid the highest prices, men-wise, this probably as any outfit did. Putting this in animal deals, like you had a dog and you said, seek him. That's what you did for those Japanese, and they would not stop.
Go for broke. That was their motto. Mm-hmm. You proud of what you did?
Well, not proud. Not that way, but I'm thankful that I was able to go through it and then get back out of it. Whenever you have two crashes in a glider and live through them, I wouldn't want to go through it again, but I'm glad I did.
And we're thankful for what you've shared with us today. That's Vernon Martin, 92 years old. Check out what he looks like now and what he looked like in uniform at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time for a decorated F4U Corsair pilot who will remind us again, as Mr. Martin did today, that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.